You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Many of you will have seen Clark McFarlane's alter ego, Mario Queen of the Circus, at the Edinburgh Festival or at festivals all over the world in the smash hit shows Le Clique or La Soirée. He's a top-level variety/comedy act and he's absolutely standing ovation brilliant. So here is Clark McFarlane. So, Clark,
thank you for coming onto the show.
Thanks for asking me, Stu.
You are better known as Mario Queen of the Circus.
That's true.
And I was just saying, you're, other than the famous Phil Burgers, you are one of the first non-stand-ups that I've had on the show. So I think a lot of people who've been to Edinburgh can't have missed you. I think a lot of people will go, who is this Clark McFarlane? And then they'll go, oh, it's that guy. Yeah. So tell us, in your own words, what the character of Mario is and the work you've been doing with him.
I call him a pansexual fan of Queen. He's sort of Freddie Mercury's biggest fan, so he takes all his style cues from Freddie Mercury. So he does like the leather daddy with a mustache and cop cap with a metal chain. And he speaks with a Spanish accent, and it's like as if he's sort of learned his English from rock and roll music. I mean, he's really doesn't speak English very well, and you know, he's a character that I really love to do because there is a lot of kind of innocence about him, and which allows him, and total sexual unrepression. Mm-hmm. So that allows him to be sort of racy in a very subversive way. So I can do very blue kind of stuff, but he's just so innocent about it.
He's so innocent, he's so naive, isn't he? He can do jokes about ecstasy without it, the drug ecstasy, without it seeming dirty or seedy at all.
Exactly, and it's not, and he inhabits a completely fantasy world of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, but he's like a little child doing it. And he's as also, and I also like, the thing I really like to about him that I'd better like it, because it's all I've been doing for the last 5 years, but is that he glorifies Freddie Mercury.
Yeah.
And that makes him by nature extremely low status because he's sort of a fan. So that's his sort of flaw, his weakness.
Oh,
he's a real fan. You know, the put on the pedestal kind of thing. And I relate to that because I'm a fan of not necessarily Queen, but things and music, and
sure.
I put things on pedestals, and I, you know, I go see my favorite.
Have you seen this? This is amazing.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
I get really swept away by things, and so that's his shtick, and which makes him very low status in a way. So therefore, he can kind of also be a rock star, and sort of unironically put himself in the position in front of a crowd as this big kind of character, and I get away with that, and you know, with the, I end my shows with crowd surfing, mm-hmm. and the people carry me, and that's a very sort of like you know, the sort of rock god thing to do.
Sure.
But he could do it because he's already so sort of he's submissive, he's sort of subservient, he's like it's all in the glory of Freddie Mercury. It's sort of like it's like a the way a minister can have a big personality or something, a big ego kind of style personality, but it's all for Jesus, you know.
Yeah, sure.
So okay. He can be with the crowd in that way. And so it's a real pleasure to be both a rock star and trying to be also a silly clown as well. So
sure. And the context in which you've been working, for people that haven't seen you, is you've been in La Soirée, which is the which followed Le Clique. Were you in Le Clique as well?
Le Clique and La Soirée, yeah. Had a little name change, little fighting, little producer fighting at the top. No sure. big deal. Everybody's fine.
Okay. But I've also seen you. I think I first met you when you were doing that show on the street.
Yes.
As a sort of 45-minute to an hour festival street show.
Right.
So and a busking street show as well.
Yeah. Also busking street show. Most of the work I do solo with that show is like paid festivals in the European outdoor sure. Festival
series. Which means you're not collecting the money
right,
in the house
for busking. Yeah. But I still love to busk with that show. I've been really lucky because that character kind of fit in. And when I first started doing this one juggling number, which started the whole thing, which was mm-hmm. where I derived the entire concept, just by juggling three balls to the song Another One Bites the Dust. Ha ha ha! Get it?
You say that, but I took and I should say this as well for people that haven't seen this. I'm often bringing guests to this podcast that people are aware of, and maybe others that some are less aware of. But you know, it's easy for you to sort of sit there and go ha ha ha.
Yeah.
It's an incredible act. It smashes it. Certainly, every time I've ever seen you work, people have been on their feet going crazy.
Yeah, it crosses over. And what I really when I came up with the act, I was really afraid of it. When I first started to do it. And that's I've realized in creating is a really good feeling to have about an act.
In what way were you afraid?
I was afraid it was the stupidest thing I could possibly do in public. I was alone in my room and I was in my apartment in New York and I was choreographing he was just a bartender in a show I was in, this Leather Daddy, and I just thought the bass line for Another One Bites the Dust would play and I would do some bar tricks with bottles, sort of a little manipulation thing, and he wouldn't speak. He was just, if he spoke, it was like to take a drink order. I mean, he was just in the show as this other character, and then the music was playing through and I had looped it with the bass line, but then I was, the song, you know, after five loops on this little mini disc edit I made, it would go into the song again mm-hmm. and it would start to do the lyrics, and then I started to sort of play with the lip sync.
Okay.
And then I was like working with three balls with it just because it started to get boring with the bottles, and then I just touched it like it was fire. I went, oh my god, if I do a three ball routine dressed like this guy lip syncing that music, I felt like a girl alone in her bedroom singing into a
brush. Yeah.
Completely, like, this is so humiliatingly weird. Like, I was afraid of it in that moment. I was like, no. Oh, my God. And then it was like, okay, hang on. This is either, like, embarrassing or totally awesome.
Yes.
And I felt that a lot. I've done a lot of acts since then that have fallen completely on the side of embarrassing.
Have you been chasing that same thing? Have you been thinking to yourself, hey, maybe I should go towards what I find humiliating?
Well, it wasn't the first time I created an entire concept around a skill set.
Okay.
So, like, when I was juggling clubs, I sort of designed the mood and style to go with this that became my old double act, Planet Banana.
Okay.
Which was, like, kitschy, and it was just, like, just because juggling is so, you got to see what the audience is seeing.
Yeah.
And juggling is not, I'm never impressed by juggling myself, and I certainly don't expect an audience to be impressed by juggling.
A refreshing attitude for a juggler. Sure.
Yeah, I think it's because I learned when I was very young, and a lot of guys learn when they're teens, and it's like the thing they can do, and it's like I learned before I had hair on my nuts, so it was like for the longest time, I mean I could really understand what an audience sees when they see juggling, which is, they see something in front of a performer that they would like to see, and that's really a boring thing to watch. It's like someone folding a sheet of laundry for your entertainment, but very quickly.
Sure, but very quickly. I should say as well, I don't know how many fans of juggling there are. Certainly in the UK, there are no famous jugglers. People equate it with, it's kind of a loser skill.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it does make people watch. And we know from our own experience of the street performing and circus performing, people do go mental over juggling.
Yeah. It's a weird thing that street performing, I mean, because I don't think they realize that people steal stuff in street performing world, people steal stuff because they see it working. But yeah, the juggling, it's not what you're, that's not what you're stealing.
Sure.
Like that you could literally do anything and do the rest of it.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter that you're juggling torches. I mean, and it's just such a funny, limiting little world that happens sometimes with that.
Nobody wants to watch juggling,
but it suddenly came out of the thing to do on the street.
It's the thing you can do whilst you're doing something else, like you're balancing on a rope or a unicycle.
Right, to make everyone just
look. If you do a thing which basically you blow up a bag and pop it, then they go,
exactly, yeah. Same thing.
But it's funny you should mention folding a sheet. I saw one of those things that go around the internet of actual advice tips that are little GIFs or photos, and they say, you know, why not put a drinking straw through the little circle in the can of in the opener on your can of soda, and it'll hold it in there,
right.
Stuff like that.
And
one of them I laughed out loud, and Carl said what, and I got up and showed it this morning, was a GIF image of someone folding a t-shirt in such a way that you take it here and here and you go flip and it's folded.
Wow.
And I was like, whoa, check this out. So I did have that similar, just you say folding a sheet.
Yeah.
There is a pleasure in watching someone move
exactly.
something.
Yes, absolutely. It's a visceral thing. You're watching things fly around. I'm not unimpressed by juggling. That's extreme. But I will say, it's the same feeling I get from watching someone play scales on a guitar. It's like,
understand.
Look at those fingers move. But you need to play music.
That's a brilliant analogy. Yeah, okay.
And that's what juggling becomes. So I looked at it as sort of a three-dimensional thing. So with the clubs, it was like this cheesy sort of kitschy dude. And then with the balls, this rhythmic, with that song and the whole costume concept that came along with doing lip-syncing to Queen. And now I have this character who's hula-hooping.
Okay.
And since I look like such a dork hula hooping, it's not a sensual, sexy thing like most hula hoopers. No matter how hard I try, just gotta face fact. I'm sort of this goth sort of character, sort of a skinny jeans rocker dude.
Okay.
Who's very awkward, and so that's sort of like coming from the skill set to the characters is what I like to do, because then it. Because then they can sort of exist, and then when they do the skill set, it's like, oh wow, that really
sure.
fits that thing.
I really want to see you being a goth hula hooping actor.
Oh,
I can just tell you, already. I'm like, yep, that's totally gonna work.
Yeah. It's funny. Yeah, I want to. It's too bad. I'm getting older though. Those goth guys are all really young. I'm thinking of this character as a younger dude, but like, I have to wear makeup or something.
There's some old goth pictures of old goths available online.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
Kiss
fans
true, yeah.
and well, I know
that's
they're not
true,
goths,
yeah.
but. You know, there's definitely that. So I think that's interesting what you said about the juggling being what's in front of the performer.
Yeah.
Because the juggling isn't your only act. There's obviously you do a crowd surf to We Are the Champions.
Yeah.
And you do the unicycle. You ride a unicycle with a member of the audience balanced on your shoulders.
Right. Sure.
So you're doing skills, but ultimately what we're watching is you kind of doing anything.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what's nice also about the characters, because it fits in that. My limitations as a performer exist in sort of like I do have these skills that I learn, and I want to present them. Context for presenting them for the audience to not just think, okay, now whatever he was doing now he's doing the skill.
Yeah.
The context with the music of Queen and just me being a complete buffoon or not buffon.
Sure,
buffoon,
sure, yeah.
Colloquial. It fits that I do these skills. Like it fits Mario because he is the queen of the circus.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a nice thing to play with. And kind of endless. I mean, I have this other street show that I've been trying. So I have this second show, and it's just mm-hmm. going really, really slowly. But it's sort of endless. I mean, Queen wrote 20 albums, so the ironic lyric use of the music, it just doesn't end.
So you wrote another show for Mario for the same character.
Yeah.
So what sort of things have you put in that show?
I'm Antonio Banderas meets with me and says that if I use the skills of the circus and the music of Queen and his sexy accent, that I'll become the Queen. But I'm first the Prince.
Okay.
And then I meet the Queen, who's a volunteer from the audience, and then she picks me as a volunteer, and then I kill her.
Okay.
So, and become the queen by murder and treachery.
Okay.
And so it's sort of an epic story. It's very ridiculous. And it's hit and miss. It's taken me a long time to get it together. I call it the new show. People are like, another one? I'm like, no, same new show I was working on 4 years ago.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Well, at least you're not in that thing that we could identify with a lot of street and variety performers where people go, have you seen my new show?
Yeah.
What I mean is, I'm wearing a different hat.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, true. There's... repackaging.
Let's talk a little bit about the verbal stuff that you do as well, because you're not just a circus performer, and I don't mean just a circus performer, you're not simply a circus performer, but you've also got, I mean, you really do straddle the line of stand-up comedy. I can't imagine I'll have many other jugglers on this show. You know, you've got some very strong stand-up skills and one-liners.
Thank you, Stu. Yeah, I play to my limitations, like I said, and I'm not a great juggler, and I'm not a great stand-up, so I juggle stand-up. But I really love. I've always been a massive fan of stand-up comedy. In when I was 10 years old, I auditioned for a professional theater production of A Christmas Carol.
Okay.
And everyone else was reading poems or doing some kind of, you know, they were doing their 10-year-old. Stanley Kowalski or whatever, and I did a stand-up bit. I did 2 minutes of this airplane humor act that I got off the radio. That my brother and I were like worshiping this radio show every Sunday called the Comedy Hour. And it was 2 hours, and we had we would record it right next to the radio, and so it was all those acts. And all the Fireside Theater and Mel Brooks and Woody Allen and Stiller and Muir and Bob and Ray, you know, all these great like classic kind of things. That was just, we worship that stuff as fans putting it on a pedestal.
Sure.
And so I got the part of Tiny Tim, and in that show was a guy called Seth Herzog, who I went to school with, and he's a New York comic, and he runs a show called Sweet in the downtown, and it was, so from then on, like, it was just all about, being this fan, touching the world once in a while by doing shows in New York and stuff as Mario, talking, and feeling actually really welcomed by that downtown scene, actually.
Sure.
Really, which was not the case. I just had a conversation with a bunch of variety performers who were sort of slagging stand-up, and, you know, just as a way of, like, when they perform in those venues, they get, like, attitude backstage or something, or sure. Just like, oh, props comedy, or your costume and stuff.
Totally, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that in comedy. I think stand-ups are very insecure about their own art, and so if something, it's very, very, I think stand-ups are often very quick to judge if something isn't really what we do. You wouldn't understand. You're not out there doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, exactly. There's a dogma to follow. And I mean, I've never followed dogma in any area of my life, so I don't. I'm not, strictly, like I said, a strict juggler or a strict stand-up or a clown or anything. But I didn't find that to be the case at all. And during the time that I was in New York, we were advertising that theater show where Mario was the bartender, and. We were right around the corner from this show called Invite Them Up with Eugene Merman and Bobby Tisdale. So I would go on stage to do my juggling act and then start to talk beforehand and to introduce it. And that was the first time I'd ever gone on stage where people didn't know I was going to juggle. Like, all of the stage shows and everything, all through that thing, I would always... It was so obvious.
You come out, you go, I'm a juggler.
I'm a juggler. I'm sure. Or there's juggling things just sitting there or whatever. Yeah. And this is the first time I was on the mic, like, standing out in front of people... without them knowing I was going to juggle and trying to win first on that
how thing. Was that?
That was I was shitting myself. I mean, it was amazing. It was like, it was, and I, that was probably the time that I touched stand up the most, because it was like, oh my god. And then to say something, and then for everyone to laugh, and then the light is there, and just this laugh comes, and you just—it's like this total like heroin rush. Like, this is it. Yes, I was wearing a costume. Yes, I had an accent.
Yeah, I was doing a funny voice.
Still like, yeah. But they laughed, and it was. I was like, okay. I mean, obviously, like I said, a huge fan, coveting that kind of relationship with the audience, where it's just. It's like hand-to-hand combat, you're right. Sure. There, it's not, I get my whole hunting gear together and my laser sight and my, you know, that's my kind of combat, you know, that you guys are out there hand to hand. And so I have so much respect for it. But I was very welcome. I felt very welcome by that world. Like they were just so, that it fit right in with what they were doing at that time, which is this kind of what they called alt comedy.
Okay.
No one was making any money. They were all writing for the shows that, mm-hmm. that run in New York. All the writers for the shows would come down. David Cross would come down. Jeanine Garofalo would come down. Like everybody was just doing bits that they would write for just that show that night. Yeah. So 8-minute bits, stand on their own kind of pieces and not doing kind of joke, and maybe trying in some jokes. I mean, it depended on who was doing it and what they were into, but I mean, you just saw such raw first run and only run material every single night. And then I would come out and be in a costume and joke and just fit in. It fit and people loved it. I mean, you know, the comedians were really behind it. And, we were not in direct competition with each other. There was something about being, these guys were, a lot of them were writers. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so I think that was part of the thing that made it easy on me to be part of that scene without any kind of attitude. I got no attitude.
Sure. And I mean, maybe I would hazard a guess, because you're writing in for the Mario character, that's the only time I've seen you do the equivalent of stand-up stuff. That writing is very strong. So presumably, if you were going out there and getting laughs before anyone knew you were a juggler, you kind of won their respect in maybe a way that wouldn't have happened if someone came out and was like doing a juggling spot.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. And it's not. Yeah, I think that's true, because also, I mean, if you do what we call in the street business patter. Mm-hmm. That's something different, where you're sort of talking and doing juggling.
And now I look at this. And if you want to see this, let me hear you say
Or this is juggling in San Francisco. And,
yeah,
you know, it's like that kind of stuff. It was more.
Yours are much more like one-liners. Like, you know, it's not a surprise to me to hear that you were interested in Woody Allen when you were a kid. You know, because they're short, tight jokes. Your line about, I mean, one of my favorites is the one about, you know, it's not a good idea for me to take ecstasy while I do my show. Yeah. I learned that the fantastic way.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a wonderful joke, you know.
Yeah, thanks.
So this is Clark. Towards the end of the show, you'll find an extra 10 minutes tacked on from a secondary sort of a backup interview that I did with Clark. More explanation on that at the time. I'm enjoying spreading my wings a bit here to include some very different types of comedians other than just stand-up. I'll be chucking some clowns in there, some variety performers as well, and there'll be some musical acts, double acts and so on coming up. As you will hear, Clark is a lot more respectful of stand-ups than certain bearded, naked, sweating clowns I could name. So even if you found the interview with Phil Burgers a bit challenging, please don't be put off. I don't think you should be put off. I've got a bit more respect for you, my dear listener, than that. But just don't panic if you're one of the people that's like, oh, bloody clowns, hate stand-up. I think there's a lot to learn here from someone who, if you haven't seen him, you should definitely seek out. If you need to get in touch with me, it's info@comedianscomedian.com, or you can tweet @comcompod. I've been enjoying loads of your correspondence. I try to get back to it whenever I can, and at the moment most of my focus and attention is on trying to find you amazing international and Australian acts here at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, so I'll get busy with that. There is a new live show, like the Acaster one that we did. It will star Mr. Benny Boot. I'm very pleased to tell you that's now on. Tickets will be available very soon from the link on the Facebook page, so check there. That's not for a long time. It's not till Wednesday the 29th of May. But there are a very limited number of seats. It's a room that we've picked in conjunction with Crack Comedy, run by the lovely Eric McElroy. There is a finite. Last time I tried to do it the other way around, so you booked and then I booked a space based on how many of you there were. This time there is a finite number of seats. It's something like 100 or maybe just under. So I think if you don't know Benny Boot, then you should immediately look him up on the Googles. And he's just one of my favourite comics. He's so exciting. And he's one of those people who I feel like I'm bagsying now, because he's definitely going to be massive. So Wednesday the 29th of May, that's Benny Boot. Tickets available from the link on the Facebook page. I shall now return you to Clark McFarlane.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Did you ever want to pursue stand-up? When you felt that rush, did any part of you think, hang on, I could put this stuff down and go for this? Or was it...
I already knew it was too late. I know what makes a great stand-up, and you have to start. You have to be doing it. You have to be needing to do it by age 16 to 19.
Okay.
I think so, to be great.
And There's a lot of new acts listening to this who are older than that, and right now their hearts are breaking, but no, I'm not disagreeing with you.
I was 32 when I did that.
Yeah.
And okay. I had already been a variety performer and a street performer, and I had a whole business of going over to Europe and doing things, learning my show in other languages, going up. I mean, my whole career and business was somewhere else. I mean, I didn't... I may have thought I wanted to be a stand-up as a sort of the same way at one point I thought I'd want to be an actor.
Yeah.
But I also had a very sort of strict, waspy upbringing that said, you need to make money at what you do. And you know, I always had a commercial sense of you know, my creation process early on was completely commercial. With the street shows, you know, get a high unicycle, light the damn torch on fire, make money, travel around. I mean, it was just, I was just saying the other day, I was afraid what I wouldn't have done to make that lifestyle work. It was so much fun in my 20s to do that. But so by the time I was starting to trust myself as an artist to actually create shows, but it was always going to be in the outdoor arena. It was always going to be in the variety arts. So just straight stand-up. I find Clark actually quite boring. You'll find that when you re-listen to this podcast that Clark is boring. And on stage, Clark talking to an audience for whatever, an hour, making jokes, being this guy, like stand-up.
Sure.
I can't picture it. It's okay. Like, I want to be three-dimensional. I want to be this other thing and have people, you know, I want to invite them into this theatrical world of whatever it is. It's got to have, for me, you know, music and costume and stuff. I like that world. I like
okay.
So just, you know, jeans and a t-shirt coming out talking about internet porn, I can't do it. It's not interesting to the audience or me.
So what do you get out of your performances? What is it that drives you? Obviously,
cash.
You know, there's
no,
cash. Well, there's a commercial aspect.
Absolutely not. I mean, yeah, I find like what I'm bringing to the game is a great deal of love, and happiness as Mario. Like when I'm out as Mario, he's the most beamingly positive kind of, and that's what I really like about the image is that at first people are very scared by the costume. It's quite, as the years go by, it's less and less. But I think in 2005 it was very scary to people, dressing up like a leather daddy and standing on a suitcase on a pitch.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good point, actually. I suppose I've seen it most recently so many times in a Spiegel tent or in a venue. Actually, to think of you doing that standing on a case in the street, that's
scary,
quite
to the
arresting,
audience as well.
It?
It's kind of confronting when I come out with the little pants on and everything, and the people are like, "What's it? You know, what is this going to do?" And what I really like is then to subvert that by being, and I can even go more over the top, beaming with this positivity because I'm wearing the costume, and the costume can be even tighter because I'm beaming with this kind of thing. Okay. So I like that, the interplay between those things. And so that's what I get out of that surprise and that kind of... I like that dynamic that I can create in someone's mind while they see me and then hear me speak, and I just really like that that combination of things. Those are my ideas. Like I really, and that's what I love. That's what I covet about stand-up, is that these ideas that people are coming out with, these beautiful, it's philosophy. I mean, you know, the stand-up, you know, the Mel Brooks thing, the stand-up philosophy, and to come up with these concepts that just make people laugh, and I really enjoy that. But the way I kind of create my ideas for people, it's less in the words, I guess.
Do you feel, is there any downside to the success that you've had with Mario? Do you feel trapped in having made something brilliant?
No, I'm lucky because of the Soiree show. You just totally baited me to be such a wanker. You're like, did you? I just heard the last bit of your question now in my head as I was answering that. What were you saying about? What were you saying about the brilliantness? Oh, the downside of brilliance. Oh.
Minimal. No, I just did, what I had in mind was you were saying you were making a new thing with a goth hula hooping or new shows, new work.
Yeah,
and because I think what I'm getting at is, you've spent a long time doing this character and doing it brilliantly. When I took my friends to see the Soiree the other night, I'm watching the same act as I've seen, and it's honed and it's brilliant. There was a comic I had on the show called Noel Britton, who's a writer, if you know Noel from the street.
Yeah, sure.
Well, he's wonderful, but he talked about something which no one else had spoken about. I'm surrounded by my day-to-day fellow performers, are people who turn over a lot of material.
Yeah.
Noel was talking about spending 20 years sharpening one act to like an invisible point. And it was interesting seeing you and Frodo's tennis racket act as well, and just sort of going, I've seen this before, and it's subtly different and better and more warm and more engaging.
Yeah, it's interesting. And that's what I always say about La Soiree. You know, we just finished 79 shows, and the Opera House is so beautiful and the whole thing. I was joking that I would like to maybe continue on at the Opera House in some way if I could have a job that where I show up for 2 hours and work for 14 minutes during those 2 hours. What could I do? Could I clean an ice machine for 14 minutes and then just have my lunch break? And, no, that doesn't exist, a job like that. It was just, and that's what keeps me going. But 79 shows, 8 shows a week, every single night, delivering the exact same jokes in the exact same order. Stu, it's hard. It's really, really hard. And I don't complain about it because it's also so small-mindedly hard. It's hard like a marathon running or, you know, it's like, I just got to run. I got to do it. I got to do it. I mean, it's not like it becomes acting, really. It becomes it's not comedy at all anymore. It's much more close to what actors do, which is to try to create this feeling and moment again. And, in a live audience situation. These guys that are doing the tough plays every night and doing the same, you don't improvise when you're doing,
Sydney Opera House.
Like, or Mammoth, you're saying the words that are off the page. And that's the thing that makes it, at least, the thing that makes it doable for me. And it's just these stupid little jokes, first of all, and it's just 4 minutes. What makes it doable is that, first of all, I wrote the stuff. Second of all, the audience is there every night, eager, laughing, loving it. The energy in that room, because La Soiree is just creates this atmosphere. Mm-hmm. The audience is so happy every night. So you they bring it. And if you're not into it backstage, you are into it on the stage.
Yeah.
Like, full stop. And so that's what's so great also about this gig, is it's a hot knife through butter almost every night.
Yeah.
And that really, but it is hard. It's really, and I do visualizations, like I was joking, I have a visualization where Mario kills Clark physically.
Okay.
And because when I'm on stage and I'm more Clark than Mario, I can really feel it. And I'm looking out the crowd and I'm overthinking and I'm not happy. I'm not doing the joy that Mario needs. And I'm just Clark on stage in a very subtle but real way. So backstage, before I go on, I've been Mario breaks Clark's neck and leaves him, or he stabs him.
I see, by visualizations, you mean pre-show?
Yeah, yeah, I have a visualization where I actually kill... Mario is strangling the regularly dressed Clark to death, and then I can go on stage as... He's gone. He's not in me. He's totally gone. He's dead.
And does that work since
you
started doing
definitely.
That?
Well, it's this kind of like... it just sort of... It's like a trans... It becomes a sort of transformation. Like, I try to... And actors have... If I was a real actor, I'd be warming up for an hour beforehand, getting into character, doing physical and vocal warm-ups and stuff like that. And I am doing... What I'm doing is even though it's a very... just a bit part in the play of La Soirée, it's acting. It's what I'm doing is acting. So I should probably warm that up more other than just panicked visualizations of killing my regular persona.
Is that healthy, do you think, to imagine your character killing yourself?
Oh yeah, it's fine. It's just an imagination. Sure. I don't want to do myself in.
I'm looking forward to this being played on the radio when you snap and kill the other members of La Soirée. Right. We knew.
Exactly, yeah. Look at that suicide. Oh, wow. He did kind of...
There were signs. Mm. So before then, when you're backstage, do you feel that you switch it on? You're quite low key backstage. You're not kind of zoning yourself in, and then you just have a moment of going, here we go.
Yeah. There's ways. Yeah, we kind of get psyched. We psych each other up. It's a great atmosphere in the dressing room with the other acts, and we're joking around, and it's like a college fucking locker room sometimes back there, with the way we carry on, but. Yeah, very short amount of time before I go on stage, I sort of become what I will be, as close to Mario-ness that night, just right before I go on stage.
Sure, sure.
But it's the other thing about doing it 70 shows in a 10-week period, 80 shows, is the skills get incrementally better. And that's really nice. As a skill, I'm still a juggler. I love the fact that I can find new things with that act. That gets incrementally better, while the comedy and some of the vulnerable stuff slowly erodes.
Do you think so? That's interesting.
Sometimes.
Okay.
I don't hit certain pitches. I mean, there's that one speech I do, which is very hard to really nail. We Are the Champions speech.
Oh, about killing the animals.
Yeah, which is this sort of ironic thing that I wrote while I was listening to a lot of David Cross, actually. I would completely cite him as a...
It is quite David Cross, isn't it? I'd never noticed that
before. Yeah, it's just
yeah.
that thing, like, you know, he has that whole bit about, this is just so over-the-top, wrong, ironic about how 8-year-old boys are asking for it.
Okay.
When the priests, you know, just with their little innocent
thing.
And it's just so wrong, and the audience is just like, and I never go that far, but I just love the idea about going that far, because obviously he's joking. Like, it's so cartoonishly awful what he's saying. But it's so funny because he said it, and I love that kind of thing. So,
You're doing with it is what your speech says is, we are the champions, and people sort of, you trick people into thinking it's a thing.
Yeah.
About, hey, listen, we are the champions, so really we should be killing all the animals. Yeah. We're in charge of them. We can just kill them.
Yeah, we can kill animals. The idea that, you know, we're all and what the idea of that also is for me is that any dogma, any kind of thing where you say, like, everything's going to be all right if we just do this way, and that will always break down. There's a philosophical end to every kind of argument that makes everything okay in our human mind that really doesn't, is not consistent. That's just the way the world is. There is no fully consistent answer to our problems. And so once someone starts to pontificate like that and just go, oh... You know, and I get really cynical, and so to make that left hook is such a pleasing thing to do every night, and to hit the tone with them, the almost crying, if the audience is really almost a tear in their eye when I say that there's a human heart beating within us all, if I hit that tone and then the left hook, it's just such a great pleasure. Again, a small-minded pleasure. 80 shows in 10 weeks, like, I'm doing the same lines. I've done that joke forever. I actually can say that whole speech in 5 languages.
Really?
Yeah.
Which are the languages?
Italian, French, German, Spanish, and English.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So you were saying that's one of the hardest bits to get right?
Yeah.
And why is that, do you think?
because it's sort of a dramatic journey. It has to amp. You're still sort of listening to where the audience is hearing it, and so you're still sort of reacting to that while you're saying it, but it has to sort of just keep building, and then that sensitivity of really getting to that, really trying to connect on a real, in a real way that, and it's a big thing to say, like, there's a human heart within a song, and some people don't want to hear that at that moment in the show at all. It works better in my full-length show when they're really with you.
Yes,
it works much better.
Yeah,
I can hit it, and I'm more into it. I'm fully, you know, I again just come from backstage, and I'm there trying to give this Mario performance. So it's just difficult. I mean, it's acting. It's like it's a monologue, and I'm not an actor, and I'm a variety. I'm a juggler.
It's kind of your most stand up-y bit, really. When you're talking about it, then it's a concept. You're leading us, you know, on a conceptual journey where you're trying to prove the opposite of something,
right.
Almost. And that's a very stand up.
Yes. And I really every night, and the way I get there every night, at least, you know, halfway or 70% I try, is because I find it really funny. It made me almost collapse with laughter when I thought of it, right, driving my truck around. I remember when I thought of it and I thought, oh my god, that's funny. I'm gonna write that.
Let's talk about writing then. Let's talk about where the written stuff comes from, where the verbal stuff comes from. How much of that, your one-liners, are any of those improvised, or did you sit down and write them and try them out? What's the process for you?
I thought you were going to ask me this, and I'm sure a lot of stand-up comedians would love to hear how I can come up with almost two jokes a year. almost two jokes a year. My process. No, I should write more. I write when I'm really
tired. I should point out at this juncture, almost no stand-up that I've ever interviewed considers themselves to have a specific process.
I write when I'm tired. I think I've only ever written when I'm totally jet-lagged and up at 3 in the morning.
Okay.
That's when something happens to my brain that makes...
That dreamlike state.
Yeah, the dreamlike... Yeah. But I really... It basically, if I think of something to say, or a way that Mario can talk about something, which is not a lot of topics he can talk about. He can't talk about his family or the internet, or he can't talk about... he can talk a little bit about the internet, as long as it's seriously gross.
Why do you say that? Why do you say he can't talk about his family?
His real family. I can't talk about my...
Oh, you're sure. I understand, yeah. But you could invent a family for
yes,
Mario.
Yes, he does have jokes about his mother and stuff, and but I guess so. Once I find a topic that he can talk about, I get really excited, and then I start thinking about things. And once something happens in my brain that actually makes me laugh right as I thought of it, then that's the only thing that's ever made it to the stage. If I don't laugh,
okay.
If I don't actually physically, it makes me laugh when I think of it.
Sure.
Really laugh. I mean, not just kind of think, oh, that's a joke. Yeah, that could be kind of good. But actually, when it surprises me enough to make me physically laugh at the moment, then that's the only things I ever say on stage are things that have made me laugh.
That's fascinating. I can really appreciate that. I think no stand-up I've had on the show has said that before, but I think that's a big part of the process. There is a certain feeling in you write something, it makes you laugh, and you want to ring someone and tell them.
Yeah.
I mean, that, that thing. But that's fascinating to think that you're, because of the nature of your act and the nature of yourself, your quality control is so high that only that stuff does it. So you don't ever try out any stuff.
Yeah, that I don't. I mean, I guess, or if I'm if there's something in there that lives with that, maybe there's some pre-jokes that I could say, and I do try stuff. And in those days when I was doing those nights with the downtown comics or whatever, I would get up and say different kinds of things and kind of go do sort of bit style stuff, more stand-up-y kind of, where it's a whole, I'm talking about a topic for a while, not just sort of making a joke. But and that was the struggle, was because a lot of that stuff Mario can't really talk about a lot of that stuff. It doesn't really fit. Like, why? I mean, a stand-up once said after a set I did, he was like, why do you hide behind your mustache? And you know, that stuff, that material, that doesn't really fit the character, like what you were doing. You were talking about like Thanksgiving dinner or something, you know, the holiday in America. And I'm like, well, and I've used the old, there's a clown sort of saying, the red nose on a clown is not, they're not hiding behind the nose. It makes the audience see them more.
Yeah, okay.
And but he was right in a way, because but it wasn't to not do Mario, it was not to do that material.
Yeah, sure, okay. I want to talk a little bit more, if we can, about, because I simply can't imagine doing the same act for that length of time.
Yeah, yeah.
I suppose in a kind of way I can, because I've got a street show that I've done thousands of times.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's been interesting for me being at this festival, doing stand-up every night, and for that weekend of the festival, doing street shows every day, and kind of recognising the difference between them. Mm. I think my own street show, by its very nature, is very haphazard and improvisy, and there's a couple of jokes in it, but there are a few jokes in it, original jokes, which I've said hundreds and hundreds of times. So I do recognise that the pleasure in getting the rhythm just right this time.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's certainly acts, there's comics I know from the circuit who are people who do the same 20 minutes all the time.
Yeah.
But how do you cope when you just talked about it like being a marathon, doing 80 shows at the Sydney Opera House. How do you cope mentally with doing that? Is it just that it's such a short amount of time? I mean, is it difficult to...
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it's such a good gig. I mean, I'm a variety performer. I should be sweating it out doing... you know, you don't know what it's like. I mean, you do know. The kind of gigs that variety performers can do.
Tell us. We as an audience don't know what it's like.
In America, variety arts, the holy grail, the best thing you can do as a variety performer in America is to work on cruise ships or colleges. College tours. So you're doing this 1 hour, your little variety. I don't know. I mean, I've just never gotten into that market. I have been.
And that's presumably, that's traveling everywhere. If you're doing colleges, that's one night.
Yeah,
in
you
a
go out,
place,
right, exactly. And you're flying out and doing these things. And I guess they're good shows. It depends on, you know, whatever, where. You could be in, you know, the cantina one night or in the big theater the other night, you know, and these gigs. And I mean, you know, and cruise ships, don't get me started. I mean, I just couldn't imagine. I'm very lucky. Who knows? I might end up on cruise ships eventually just because. That's just this gig that everybody does. I mean, I've mentally every single day I thank my lucky stars I'm in a show like La Soirée. It's such a pleasure to be in that show. It is, I think I am what has made me not a great juggler and not a great stand-up and not a great really a, you know, full stop say street performer. Mm-hmm. Is the same thing interplay in my small mind that goes, oh, I get to do the show again. Yeah. I'm just like that. I have pleasure from that. I really do. I love to do it. So it becomes extremely easy in a way. And it's like you're on vacation in Sydney for 10 weeks, basically. I mean, the whole day you're just hanging out. It's fun. And someone else is doing all the work. I mean, I've self-produced. I organized my own tours in Europe, and it's just a pain in the butt. You know, when someone else is doing everything for you, you just show up on time. That's all you have to do. So, but you're right. I mean, it that magic of creating and doing stuff and being around Adelaide, of course, you know, and seeing everybody doing their thing. And I mean, I try to create outlets for myself, like the new Mario Street show and the new character where I can do in different weird nights, you know, the weird lineup nights that variety is not frowned upon. I do my little shtick and do new stuff there and host things and try to keep Mario alive in other ways. But that 8 shows a week is the gig of gigs for me. It's such fun to be a part of it.
One of the biggest things that I think I struggle with as a comic, and I'm in a very privileged position, but certainly here being in Australia is fantastic. I'm very lucky to be working full time. That's my whole income. Yeah. Comes from stand-up comedy. But one of the things I struggle with the most with this job is the constant travel.
Yeah.
And the difficulty of maintaining relationships and thinking to myself, oh, I want a kid one day. How's this going to fit in with all of this?
Yeah.
Do you find that difficult?
Yeah, I mean, we went on a very long European tour this year, my wife and I, with our at the time, just under 2-year-old.
Okay.
The 7 months leading up to his second birthday.
And actually, your wife is a performer as well?
Yes, she's an actress and a clown and a variety performer and a director. She's my director. It's great to travel with your director. She totally reels it in when it's eroding, which is great.
Sure. And she's here with you now?
No, she's at home. We have a place in Brisbane now. So,
okay.
And she's about to pop with a second baby. So,
wow.
So it was pretty intense. That tour went on too long. That was really intense. We were able to start a family and be together because this Le Clique de la Soirée thing sits in different cities for quite a length of time. So
yes,
we were in London for 9 months. She was working professionally as an actress in London while we were there, and we were in Paris for a while, and she was coming back to Australia to do acting work, and she'd be gone for a month or two doing her thing, and so we were able to just continue a relationship to the point of reproduction, which is, I feel really lucky. I've sort of had the best of both worlds. I was in a double act for years with my partner. I think you met my ex-wife. And I mean, we made it, our baby was the show, and we just worked so hard on the show all the time, and we were touring around, and just, we were in each other's pockets 24/7. That was really not the atmosphere for a third party being our child. We were just so obsessed with the show and that stuff, and eventually our relationship ended. But now with both of us doing different things and involved with different projects and able to at least stay in one city for months on end, we've really made it work. I feel really lucky to sure. also about that, because it's a huge issue. And in the variety world, for sure, people, variety artists who are together, they're spending, some guy's doing, 5 months in Macau while this girlfriend is in, on Cirque du Soleil tour in Canada. And,
sure.
I mean, it gets very, very complicated. And so, I feel very lucky that I've been able to sustain a relationship and reproduce.
Would you say that you were a workaholic?
Yeah. I was.
You were. Okay.
I'm recovering. I've always got something going on. I was known as the street performer that did all the shows, would show up.
That's kind of how I remember first hearing about you.
Yeah.
So what motivated that? Why were you working so hard?
Oh, financial. I mean, I think that everything I do now in my modern career comes from what I learned as a street performer, and not just the way to do a street show, but definitely there's a kind of. Like I said, I mean, you can deconstruct the street and what makes an audience stop and what makes an audience interested, and so I just by doing that many shows, I felt like I laid a pretty strong groundwork for my modern career, and also the idea that every opportunity to perform I would take. So I'm still doing my spot's shitty in it, doing this, the new the goth character, or doing the new Mario street show and stuff. It's like taking every opportunity to perform.
Sure.
And that, I guess you could call that workaholicism. I call it practice.
I think a lot of people, when they are workaholics in the... Well, I don't know if there is a proper sense of the word. I don't know if it's a real thing or just a thing. And I certainly recognise this in my own practice, my own workaholism sometimes, is that it comes from a place of unhappiness. That intensity, actually, there's something that I'm desperate for.
No, I think you confuse it. That's alcoholism.
Well, all the holisms, I think, come from a similar root. Let's just look quickly at your background. You say you were juggling before you had hair on your nuts.
Yes, that's right.
How come?
I started juggling. My brother was doing it, and he was doing magic with his kids on the street, and he was 6 years older than me, and he was being a nerdy magician with some just bit of juggling. And then I learned when I was 10 years old, and then and was always performing. I always loved to perform. I was in acting, like I said, that was Tiny Tim. And then that was started a paid career. College, doing shows, I was in a comedy troupe, the improv comedy troupe. We knew nothing about improv. Our improv was terrible, but we would invent these I'm still proud of the work we were doing. There was some John Lennons in that crew. There was a guy who's still writing plays now. Okay. in America. He's a very talented person. He would come up with these amazing concepts for skits, and we had such a good time. Never considered it a career. Everybody was going off to one guy went to write plays, another guy went to do Second City, mm-hmm. and still tours with them and does internet films. He's Andy Cobb and Eric Pfeffinger. I was like, I'm going to grad school. And then I took a year off, went to Colorado, met up with some jugglers out there, and there was a street pitch out in Colorado that I started sort of working on, and then this idea to go to Europe happened. And over in Europe...
So you had a street show at that time?
No, I was just sort of juggling with a case open.
Okay.
Like a saxophone player or something on a street corner. And I had no idea about a show. I went to Amsterdam the following summer after graduating from college, and I met professionals street performing, and I thought, okay, so either I go to grad school and spend the next 5 to 8 years getting some kind of degree, and I've just spent the last 17 years in school, mm-hmm. or travel the world, have fun, juggle, make people laugh, and party. I mean, that's what I mean by I would be afraid what I wouldn't have done. I completely stole my finale on a high unicycle from Richie Rich.
Yeah.
I did the whole eat the apple on a high unicycle and didn't have any qualms about stealing that whole routine. Just went out and never did it on his pitch, but I went out
sure.
did it on these small little towns all over Europe and just traveled and lived large. And then in the wintertime, went back to Colorado and had enough money to sit on my butt and have a ski pass. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my friend was growing hydro up the way. And it was just a great period of amazing love affair with a whole new lifestyle coming sure. out of college and the whole expectation and the whole thing. And I was making my own money by performing and never looked back. And it was only a few years later that I got so sick of my street show I couldn't even hear myself say it. It tasted disgusting on my mouth when I go out there because I was doing so many shows. And then I met my future ex-wife and we did a show together. And, okay. and then coming out of that relationship, that's when I did actually the Gaulier School, just the clown part of that. And that was a real kick in the butt.
Was that hard work, Gaulier? I mean, what little I know of it, it's famously painful and difficult.
Oh, it's, yeah, it was hard for me. Some people were having a really good time of it. I learned in clown school that I'm not a clown. I touch clowning. I would liken it, again, another music analogy. I play rock and roll, and clowns are in the orchestra.
Okay.
And there are moments of, you know, even in the dumb three-chord song, I can have moments of virtuosity, you know, but I'm not first violin.
Yeah.
And I have so much respect for clowns. Because what we're getting from an audience is their approval. And they can do it in so many ways. They can be impressed with us, they can laugh, they can cry, they can, you know, clap and stuff. But clowns get an approval. When they work, it's like you become like they're your best friend. It's mm-hmm. it's an approval in such a deep level mm-hmm. because they see your flaws. They're part of your they get to you, your personality, and that's what a best friend is. Someone, you know, it's like you can't you know, love someone who's perfect, as they say. So it's this kind of thing. And I love to watch clowning and be around it and stuff. But boy, Gaulier was a kick my butt. I was really not a clown. But I did learn something. On the last day of Gaulier, we all put on each other's costumes because you're given a costume towards the beginning that you have to live in the entire time.
Okay.
And that's you're not that, but you're a clown as that. And so that's kind of, and that just brings out sort of you know, you can start to go with material, whatever. I was a golfer, so okay. I was sort of this pompous golfer thing. And the last day we switched costumes with people, and no one wanted my costume because I hadn't been on stage hardly at all, because you spend on stage as long as you are good, and he beats a drum. So for over 3 weeks I spent like 15 seconds on stage. And so we switched each other, but there was this one dude, and I just could, I imitated this guy to a T. Mm-hmm. And no one even remembered that that's what he was like. And then I put his costume on, and I was doing him perfectly and killing, like the first time I'd ever killed. Yeah. And I was like, oh, right, I'm character.
Yeah, okay.
I'm not a clown, I'm character. That's my good thing. I can imitate. I do voices and physicality. I don't, it's much from the, I need to put that stuff on from the outside, that shit from the inside, that clowning from the inside just doesn't, I can't translate that clown into performance. I'm, you know, it's, and again, with financial motivation, as a lot of the things I do, if, you know, I'm working within my limitations to create something that is people want to see, and so, yeah.
Do you feel with Mario, do you feel nailed it? I mean, you must feel like you've nailed Mario. You're doing something which is commercially successful, which makes you happy, which makes audiences happy, you're killing it every night.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I mean, I definitely feel like... I feel really lucky that I came upon something like that, and it did come from a lot of the groundwork that I laid with the double act and with the street performing and everything. It kind of evolved into this, and I mm-hmm. and what was lucky about Mario, it was this the next project, but it was completely filled with everything I had done up to that point. Mm-hmm. So I got to use, instead of going on a different tangent, it was a complete piece of evolution from day one to that time. So I got to use all of the successful things that I had come up with from the beginning, and I was extremely extremely lucky that I found something that fit in that thing. And New York, I mean, and it was so inspiring being in New York and seeing all these, you know, the performance art for performance art's sake, these guys. I mean, it gave me a lot of power, gave me a lot of force, to watch people like Chris Rossi, who is a great character comedian in New York, and he's doing a thing called Tiny Confessions now, which is all over the internet. He sells these pictures, Tiny Confessions.
I'll definitely
oh my god, he's genius. And so he was doing all this stuff at that time, and all the stand-up comedians and all the variety performers back then, and just being in New York, being around that, you in the world of marketing an act, so much of the time you're asked to be doing something like something else.
Okay.
So you if I'm a freak show guy or something, mm-hmm. and I want to be like a freak show guy, so they know what that is, they market it, they people know, gotcha. They ask for it, so you're a freak show guy, or you're a Cirque du Soleil aerialist, mm-hmm. or something, so you're like, you fit in a box.
Yes.
I have been extremely lucky in my career to be asked to do something, whatever I was doing, it was because it was different from everything else.
Yes. Okay.
And that's been the motivation. That's been even the financial motivation for creating. I've been lucky enough not to have to create in the beginning, of course, I was a street act, and I needed to look like a street act and do a street act thing for sure. That was totally the financial motivation to be exactly like everyone else. But once I moved into the outdoor festival circuit, they want new acts. They want to look different. They don't want to have seen it.
Yes.
They don't want that, you know, if you're doing a corporate party in LA for a movie opening, they have the theme of circus. So you have to dress up in tights and be a circus thing. And, you know, you have to look like something and be a pegged. And the market in Europe was so much about what is new. And that's been driving my creative process since my early 30s, and I've been, that's really, I feel, that's why I love that circuit so much. It's always looking for the new thing.
So
So we're just going to add a little bit to the conversation that we had the previous day. I'm now at Clark's house. Not the previous day, it was a week ago now.
Yeah, it was a week ago.
I'm at Clark's house, which is literally in a rainforest.
Yeah.
And we've just had some refried beans, and we're going to just add another little 5 minutes on the end of this show on account of when I ran into you the day after doing the podcast. You were very excited, and you said that you'd made a note about comedy.
Well, I was drunk, and we were...
we were both drunk.
Well, and I had listened to a bunch more of your podcasts as well, and some people I admire talking about their process and things, and still within the realm of me not being a real stand-up, I did start to take a look at my goals and my things that I wanted to do, and I had this fringe... the best of fringe variety show to do, so I could sort of stretch out, and so I wrote this whole piece about that everything's a venue at the fringe, and made a bunch of jokes and did this whole little bit, and just felt so, it was so refreshing to do something outside of those minutes that I do in soiree that have to be the same every night.
Sure.
And everything, and then even took notes on other ideas and in my phone and stuff, and it was just kind of exciting to be, and I think that happens when I get around these sort of festival atmospheres with
everything
and stuff, but it was sparked by our conversation, and then we started talking about you wanted more of the real story about how I feel doing that same stuff every night, and what, you know, I mean, and one thing I didn't want to sound like a wanker by saying I do wank a lot.
You do sound that way.
Yeah, I guess that makes me a wanker. No, but by saying that I work a lot. I mean, I'm hired a lot, and I refuse more work than I do. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't want to say that also to the because... And I think this is what excited you about having this extra 5 minutes is because, of course, in my deepest, darkest, in the back of my mind, I think I'm the only reason really anyone wants to hire Mario Queen at the circus is because of Queen. And
sure.
I bring to this, the show, this great soundtrack, or this, and I bring to an outdoor theater event a great soundtrack, and people just, I'm a cover band.
Okay, so that's the fear. So that's
course,
the fear. That's
yeah.
the dark voice saying
yeah.
they only want you because you're a cover band.
And
how can you think that? How can you think they just want it for?
Well,
you're just a covers band.
Well, I mean,
no one watching you could ever imagine that that's what you're wearing.
Well, I mean, I guess it's never really popped up as far as a direct criticism of what I do. There was one reviewer in England for the Hippodrome season that Luke mm-hmm. did. On Leicester Square, and he was kind of curmudgeon, didn't like much, and he said I was a one joke or whatever. The joke was over immediately or something. It's never specifically about that. It's in my mind because it was a byproduct of it was never a commercial choice to use Queen. It was a byproduct of need to make a whole act. And I had one number, and I wanted to sort of expand that into a thing. And I even said, if I make another number with Queen music, then that's like a bad sequel. That'll be Rocky
sure,
Four,
sure.
Terminator
yeah.
Two. It'll be bad. And my friend, this great musician in New York, Cornmo, said, no, it's not. It's a theme. It's not a bad sequel. It's a theme. And I went, right, yeah, it's a theme. So I just sort of kept going with that idea, and then once I had this product that was also in high demand and everything, I mean, I knew in my heart of hearts, I know that I've done the pre-work. I've worked on the street for years, and I've done enough indoor stuff to know my way around that, to know that I'm giving something, I'm giving a product, but of course you think, well, but I would just be still doing the same gigs that I always was if it weren't for the fact that I've sort of borrowed this huge element of popular culture and kind of appropriated it as part of my sort of thing. And so, yeah, it's kind of like a... it makes me think that using Queen music is an element of... it's a dimension to what I do. It's
sure.
one of the things, and it does make it successful, and so why not? I mean, why?
Sure.
What everyone else uses music in the variety arts. They use
everyone
they
else
all
uses
kinds
music.
Of music.
They all use the most evocative, heart-wrenching
yeah.
or triumphant music they possibly could.
Yeah, and if I mean, there should be kind of a cap on how many numbers Total Eclipse of the Heart can be used in. but But it does kind of, you know, appropriating an entire catalog as my own is a bit, it makes me smell myself a bit hacky, definitely.
Do you think you might smell yourself like that? Do you think that ever crosses the mind of any promoters?
No. Well, maybe. I mean, but there's definitely promoters that don't hire me. But people, I think, more like that I've appropriated it so that they can kind of present it. But because it has that widespread appeal. But I also like that there is this kind of, with that widespread appeal, there is also Mario himself and that kind of character is kind of from the underground. It's from the
sure.
from the basements of bars and he that the whole persona has grown from underground theater. So it was sort of maybe a way in. It's not like I'm doing big commercial gigs anyway, so I don't even know why it bothers me. But I guess what I think is, what would it be without the Queen music? How would I survive without it? What would I do? And I do like it. The longer I'm on stage before I play any Queen music, or even talk
yeah.
about Queen music,
yeah.
it's sort of the happier I am, for that reason. But to be honest, I mean, to be really honest, like you said, I actually am really and not complacent, but definitely. Quite satisfied with my work up to this point because I do like to have a very strong foundation for everything that I go and try and do,
sure.
which is very safe. I've always been pretty safe in that way. So years of street performing before I ever tried to do a gig on street theater circuits, years of street theater circuit before I ever really moved to make an indoor circus show. And then,
mm-hmm.
and then that, you know, then once I was indoors, and then crossing over with the character stuff, that it's been such a long process of foundation building before I even try anything else. And so now, I mean, with the foundation that I have, it's really, I feel like I have a voice. We were just talking about
mm-hmm.
In conversation just about personas and stand-up personas, and I think Mario does have a sort of a stand-up-y persona that I
sure,
could
sure definitely.
Be doing, you know, not just like I'm going to make it as a stand-up now, but I mean, but
sure.
I can kind of cross back over into the world where he started, which was the, like I said,
mm-hmm.
the New York alt comedy scene. But anyway, so with that built foundation and just kind of the idea of adventure and also maybe getting moving a bit away from the Queen stuff, yeah, I'm gonna write. I'm gonna type into my phone and write more stuff for Mario. Thanks for that.
I feel like I've manipulated you into saying that. And Clark, we can't finish this interview until you thank me for
yeah.
how invigorating your process has been. I just want to say very finally then, I'm just interested in how you approach when you feel negative, when you occasionally have those flashes of, God, am I just a covers band? Do you have any kind of, what's your approach for dealing with that? Do you just shrug it off? Do you go, ah, that's just something I think, forget it? Or do you ruminate on it? Or do you go, well, do you know what? Do you know something's got to change? Or
no, I don't ruminate.
I'm only asking because I think everyone that works in comedy has those moments of, anyone that works in performance has those moments of just having a flash and just going, what am I doing with my life? How am I,
yeah,
how is
well,
this valid?
Exactly. And I mean, you
we
have
all need
this,
to get over that.
Well, something. Because, and there's also that thing, I think it's not so much that, oh, I use the Queen music. It's much deeper than that. I mean, it would be anything that would make you think, well, I'm not for real. I'm not the real deal. I shouldn't actually have ever been a performer. I'm not worthy, because you see great performers all the time. You see, you're exposed to these, you know, incredible artists
sure.
that are creating it at a rate that you could only dream about, and at a quality you could only dream about. And so that's at the core of it. Obviously, you're thinking that you yourself are not really worthy of the kind of the even doing the job that you're doing, and of course you think that once in a while, and I mean, I guess I think I try just to think about, like I said, also, I mean, that works for me to think about, well, I'm the one turning the key. I go up there and I do
yeah.
react, and when no one is there, that's, you know, that's who's doing it, me. So it's kind of like, and I have been, and so hours of trying to draw a crowd in the most dodgy places, and the bright sun or whatever, or in the cold, or in almost, you know, rainy weather. All of those hours have built up in my mind as a kind of buffer against thinking I'm not the real deal, because I have actually done it. I've paid my dues for real, you know. So I think well, you know, I think that's why I did at that time log those hours, and I'll still log those hours. I'll go out this weekend out in Brisbane and sweat my balls off doing that, and you know, and that's my penance for being a fraud.
that was so positive. I was like, oh, we got it, this is the stuff I wanted. And we ended on the word fraud. You're not a fraud. That's so lovely.
I mean, if you're not, you know, literally, if we're not, you know, Shakespeare or Mozart, we're frauds, right? I mean,
yeah, that's healthy.
But I know, of course, I know exactly what you mean, that idea of, you know, what is the point in doing this? I mean, the one that is frequently mentioned amongst UK stand-ups will be someone like Daniel Kitson.
Yeah.
When you see his stuff and you come out simultaneously elated and also feeling like, what's the point?
Oh, what is the
point?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, he does that to me too. And he's such a nice guy, the asshole.
Yeah, I know. So everyone has to sort of find a place to be on that thing of going, okay, I can't be Shakespeare, Kitson or Mozart.
Yeah, yeah.
But so what, would I rather that no one did any art and those three guys did it until they died and then there was no more?
Maybe
that would be better.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm the guy who's going to dress up like a little, you know, little leather daddy with his midriff out and dance around juggling. I mean, no one's going to do that.
This is a dark day for the Comedians Comedian podcast. Dear listener, I can't believe I've just heard myself say the sentence Shakespeare, Kitson or Mozart. I'm so sorry. I think the point we were trying to make is that when you see people be brilliant at your art, it sometimes makes you wonder why you bother. I might as easily have said Arthur Lowe, David Shrigley and Carly Rae Jepsen. Let's not focus on putting those names in a sentence together. Anyway, I'm going to go and wash my mouth out. I really enjoyed that. So many thanks to Clark. I thought it was a great interview. The idea of him murdering, his character murdering him visually as an exercise before he goes on stage, I think is something that makes me wish I had a character to try that with. So thanks to Clark. Many thanks to Santa's little helper, Sarah Grun, for her help in sort of behind the scenes production-wise. And I will speak to you lot very soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com